In December 2010, PayPal, some credit card companies, and a number of major banks were attacked by online activists upset over their decisions to block donations to WikiLeaks. Today, a group that's been dubbed the PayPal 14 will appear in federal court in a case that raises serious questions about what free speech means in the era of online activism, also known as hacktivism. Aarti Shahani is a business and technology reporter in Silicon Valley. She wrote about this issue for Al Jazeera America, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to our program today. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How did hackers attack PayPal and other banking sites in 2010?
Sure. So the specific tactic they used is called a DDoS, distributed denial of service. And it's when you have signals sent to a server in such a volume that you basically jam it up. So it's like bombarding a site so that it's clogged, ineffective, users can't use it. So this DDoS attack against PayPal effectively shut them down. Users weren't able to access PayPal. What's important to note about this attack is there are different types of hacking attacks, okay? Some attacks actually break through passwords, get into the servers of a company, grab data. This is not one of those kinds of attacks, but it did jam up their servers. And, you know, according to PayPal, it cost them $3.5 million in damages and upgrades.
Are distributed denial of service attacks difficult to pull off?
You know, they're not. In the totem pole of hacking, experts tell me, I've never done this myself, experts tell me, they're not that sophisticated, but they're very difficult to guard against. And, you know, that's the sort of asymmetry in cybersecurity, is that it's not so hard to pull off an attack as it is to defend against it, because there are so many entry points when you're talking about the internet and software.
So they're easy to do, but and they're effective as well.
I mean, that's the thing, is that it's basically low-hanging fruit by way of a tactic when you think about, you know, if you've got a gripe to pick with a company, you know, for a cause, if you want to cause damage, you know, you can go stand in front of PayPal and protest physically, or you can do a DDoS, and, you know, it's very clear what harms the company more.
Well, that is one of the issues here. If you pick it in front of a company, that's perfectly legal, but it's rather unclear as to whether this kind of action is illegal.
Well, you know, I think it's actually, to parse it out a little bit, it seems in this case, and we can talk about some other hacktivism cases where it's different, but in this case, it's not so much was it legal or illegal. As I understand from the defense attorneys I've spoken to about the case, they're all basically saying, yes, some kind of crime was committed here, but it's really how serious was it? Is it a felony offense that warrants decades in prison, which are, you know, what the indictment would lead to? Or is it something closer to a small misdemeanor where you say, hey, guys, take community service and you're done? You know, and so I think that that's really the debate happening here in the PayPal case. And it matters because, you know, DDoS attacks, cyber protesting or attacks against corporate targets and against government targets is increasingly happening.
Didn't hundreds of people take part in this operation? How did the Justice Department find and select the 14 defendants in this case? And I've heard them also described as the PayPal 13. Is somebody being overlooked here?
No, well, this is the thing, is that you could say hundreds or you could say thousands. What effectively happened in December of 2010 is that PayPal had, you know, packets coming from, you know, thousands upon thousands of computers, and they gave to the Justice Department a list of 1,000 of the top senders. So this is where we seem to get the most signals from. And what's difficult...
So they could determine who had engaged in this activity.
They could determine the computers from which the activity was coming from, which is very different from knowing who did it, right? Because I could be at my friend's place doing something. You don't know who actually hit the enter button or clicked the mouse, and that's a difficulty in cybersecurity cases. So one of the challenges for the Justice Department, you know, I'd spoken to them in reporting about hacktivism, and they weren't able to talk about pending litigation. They said that the way that they chose the handful of defendants that they chose was basically to consider prosecutorial guidelines, right, sort of at large. So, you know, what's the likelihood of recidivism? How seriously involved was someone? Were they an operator of one of the message boards calling for, you know, for online activists to go ahead and target PayPal? But the defense attorneys say, hey, I'm not really sure how this happened, scratching their heads. saying, beats me how my client was chosen.
Can you describe who these defendants are, where they come from, what their average age is?
Yeah, so they're defendants ranging from at the time of the attack, late teens through 40s and 50s throughout the United States. There were also other defendants charged by the UK in 2011 for a set of these attacks. Here, for example, Dennis Collins is one of the defendants. He's from Ohio. His attorney says that, you know, he's not that technologically sophisticated, but he's being charged with being a chat room operator. And not just in California. What's interesting is Collins and the other co-defendants are in court today in San Jose. But Collins is one of the people that's also been, for the same set of attacks, brought onto criminal charges in Virginia. So now he's in two different jurisdictions, basically, you know, trying to defend himself against very serious felony charges. His lawyer says, I wasn't allowed to talk to him. The defense attorneys wouldn't let me speak with their clients. But according to his lawyer, you know, he has lung disease and he's been taking oxygen tanks while he flies back and forth between Virginia, Ohio, and California for these court hearings.
And is operating a chat room a felony?
Well, you know, it depends. This is the free speech element of this, right, is sort of when you incite some kind of action. We're all familiar with, or many of us are familiar with, for example, change.org. You go online, you sign a petition. That's not question speech, right? That's sort of, oh, the cutting edge of online activism, a la maybe 2004. And now that we're in 2013, people are questioning what's more cutting edge. There's a separate case that I think is really interesting when we talk about hacktivism, and really question whether a law has even been violated. There's a man named Andrew Arenheimer. He's in federal prison right now. His nickname is Weave. He goes by Weave. And the Arenheimer case is fascinating because in this case, he was criminally prosecuted, jury trial convicted, but the sides continue to disagree about whether he ever even committed a crime.
Well, he's accused of hacking AT&T and turning over 114,000 email addresses belonging to iPad users to Gawker.
That's right. And so in the Arenheimer case, what's interesting is that he's known as the iPad hacker. Okay, so when iPad was first coming out and AT&T was the wireless provider, AT&T made the stupid mistake, according to them, of putting people's user IDs right in the URL, that web address where you can type in where you want to go. And so he and his co-defendant realized, oh, look at this. You know, this big company with all these resources did a really dumb thing with their security. So they wrote a script that would grab these IDs and the email addresses, over 100,000 of them. And then, you know, according to him, he went and he told AT&T, hey, this is what I did. And then, you know, very shortly thereafter, he went and told Gawker, because the thing is he wanted to shame the company. So the debate here in terms of, first of all, was this a crime? And secondly, is it a form of activism? Is it a form of free speech? Is that in the Arenheimer case, first of all, he never did any unauthorized access of a computer, per se, according to the defense, in that he didn't go past the login screen, he didn't try to jam up servers, he basically took something that was in plain sight on the internet and aggregated it. And
it's a kind of whistleblowing, isn't it, at least in his mind?
He called himself a consumer advocate. He said, hey, you guys are charging me with a felony. You're saying I'm this big, bad hacker. I'm a consumer advocate. I'm standing here for the people in the internet age because these big companies are grabbing your data, but they're not protecting you in the process. So he thought that he was whistleblowing, or that's what he said. You know, and so it's fascinating because he got convicted. A former federal prosecutor is now part of his pro bono defense team on appeal. The company Mozilla, with the popular web browser Firefox, Mozilla actually issued an amicus or co-authored an amicus brief in his case saying, hey, what Arenheimer did is really important to hold big companies accountable. He's not a hacker or he's not a criminal. He's a security researcher. And we shouldn't be locking him up. But he got 41 months.
Now, a similar case was a 21-year-old Reynaldo Rivera who hacked Sony, he said, to embarrass them.
Right. And so, we have to be careful about what we say is similar or different, because what these cases have in common are hackers who say that they have a motivation, which is a political motivation to shame a company, to expose a company, to expose, a government that's doing wrong. That's what they have in common. So their hacks are not financially motivated, but technically they're doing quite different things. So Ronaldo Rivera, he goes by Royal, you know, he did an attack on Sony that actually did break into their servers and grab customer information. And so when I spoke to him, actually, tomorrow he's going into prison for his one-year sentence. So he's a, you know, 21-year-old. He gets a year in prison, then he'll do 13 months in house arrest, and then he actually has to pay over $600,000 in restitution. So he's going to feel this for quite a while. You know, according to Royal, what he did was go ahead and hack Sony because there was this other hacker that found a way to jailbreak the PlayStation 3, and Sony went after that hacker very hard. So then other hackers went back to Sony because it's basically like, hey, Sony, we're showing that you're weak. You're retaliating against us for showing that you're weak. Well, we're going to retaliate back against you.
Did it cost Sony $600,000?
But possibly more. I mean, what's hard in these hacktivism cases is measuring damage, right? So, for example, am I measuring what it costs you as a company to go ahead and bring in some cybersecurity consultants to fix it? Am I measuring the cost of upgrading your system so that this doesn't happen again? Am I measuring what was taken by way of data, if theft actually occurred? This is a huge issue of calculating harm. Now, according to the statute that governs this from 1986, it's called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the government just has to prove over $5,000 in harm, and it's pretty much done. So with that kind of threshold, it's not particularly hard to prove, right? But, for example, in the case of Arnheimer Weave, who did the iPad hack, the AT&T case, you know, when he was convicted, the companies, the victims of the attack, are able to go ahead and submit a request to be considered in the federal sentencing. AT&T chose not to submit a request to ask the government to throw the book at him, but he still got a very stiff sentence. And so, you know, the companies have a real spread here, and I think that part of the challenge for the companies responding to this, because it's primarily, you know, corporate attacks, they are not trying to bring more attention to themselves and become the target of more hacking and attacks. And so part of the feeling is they want to be able to respond to this without government involvement. But in these very high-profile cases, the Justice Department's gotten involved.
On the other hand, to some degree, these attacks are helping them because it's alerting them to weaknesses in their systems.
Well, that's, you know, that is the thrust of this fascinating brief by Mozilla in the Arnheimer case, is that, you know, for some of these hacks, particularly the ones that are looking at security flaws and exploiting security flaws, you know, the big question is, are we looking at people who are hacker criminals, or are we looking at people who are security researchers? That's, you know, that's a really active debate, and it was fascinating to see that the company Mozilla, which is a very established company in San Francisco, very active in Silicon Valley, they explicitly said, hey, we value third-party researchers, especially in an economy where software is full of holes and we've got to find them.
I'm talking with Aarti Shahani, a business and technology reporter in Silicon Valley, who's written about the PayPal 14 and related matters for Al Jazeera America. So far, the case hasn't received much public attention. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think it has to do with how... what are we even talking about? You know, are we talking about a handful of guys that, you know, are vandals and broke into something that they didn't, that they shouldn't have broken into? And so it's just sort of like the cyber equivalent of breaking and entering into someone's home. Is that what they are? Or are they people that are standing for something and they're trying to make a point both about the internet and the movement of information, you know, as well as their roles as digital citizens, right? Like these are nascent conversations, so I think that part of the challenge in reporting them is, you know, like, for example, in the reporting that I've done for Al Jazeera, as well as, you know, I'm a reporter at KQED, your sister station in San Francisco, part of the challenge is that, you know, who you're talking to has a totally different, you know, explanation of what's going on. You talk to the hacker who did it, and it's like, hello, I'm here with a purpose. You know, we stand for something. This is obviously not in the case where there's been theft and, you know, credit card fraud and things like that. But for those kinds of hackers that are not doing this to make money, it's this belief that we stand for something. And then, you know, you talk to the companies that are scratching their heads saying, how do we handle this? You know, they're looking at a serious threat to their security when they're collecting all sorts of data that they haven't figured out how to protect yet.
Well, aren't we hearing that there are two sides to the story? For example, yesterday, the Washington Post reported that the NSA has tapped into Google and Yahoo's overseas servers, and we've been hearing a lot about the NSA listening, listening in on Angela Merkel's phone calls. Some people say this is important for national security. Others are saying, well, this is the same sort of thing that these kids are doing.
You know, I think what's interesting about the NSA leaks is that they've obviously created massive awareness and this sort of, oh, this touches me in some way. And it's kind of like, hey, if my information, if my metadata, if my communication is important enough that the government wants to bother collecting information about it and spying and surveying, maybe it actually matters. I feel like, you know, the NSA leaks and what's been happening has really elevated the conversation. You know, and then when you look at, and this is not quite hacktivism, this is related but separate in terms of digital citizenship and how countries and individuals behave. You know, what's interesting is that part of the domestic response, when you look at the polling around the NSA leaks, is people saying, well, a lot of people saying, hey, if you've got nothing to hide, what does it matter to you if you have some metadata collected? But then you have these global leaders, right, like Angela Merkel and then Francois Hollande in France and Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, who I believe was the first to start really making gripes about this a couple of months ago and bringing it to the UN. Then you start to realize there's something deeply adversarial about this, certainly in the relationship between countries. And, you know, you'd like to think that there's a way to tone this down so that it's not deeply adversarial in every interaction, both for, you know, our own economy here and then our relations abroad.
Well, you're in Silicon Valley. What are you hearing from the various companies there about what the NSA has done?
Well, a few things. And I think that what's on companies' radars, listen, the very big companies, right, like the Googles, the Facebooks, the Yahoos, the huge companies, which are the minority of companies, you know, they're concerned about international relations. I was fascinated listening to Mark Zuckerberg a few weeks ago at a conference called TechCrunch Disrupt. It's a really important Valley conference. And Zuckerberg said, you know, his reaction to the leaks and hearing, you know, the NSA say, oh, no, we're not doing this on U.S. citizens. We're just doing this abroad or to foreign nationals. He, as you know, the CEO of a transnational company that's trying to get into all sorts of emerging markets, you know, hit his head like, wrong message to send, guys. You know, I'm trying to build relations in other parts of the world. I don't want other countries thinking that we're not honoring their privacy. You know, so it's sort of a very interesting perspective in terms of the big companies that are trying to be as transnational as possible with this idea that, hey, in the internet economy, you know, it's just a few winners that are going to take all. Now, you have to remember, though, that Silicon Valley is also a place with a lot of startups and, you know, much smaller businesses that aren't the top 100 in the U.S. And, you know, they're trying to think of their minimum viable products and how can they get off the ground. And I think that for them, you know, forget NSA leaks for a moment, the issue of cybersecurity and the threat of hacking, what that might cost them, you know, that can be a real game changer in terms of killing a company. And so I think that there's a lot of concern. You know, I'm right now at a cybersecurity conference in Mountain View, and there's a lot of concern among the startups of, you know, this stuff is so widespread. My business is based on collecting data from people, but the cost of securing that data is so high, it just maybe doesn't make dollars and cents.
Well, Brad Arkin, Adobe's chief security officer, wrote in a blog post last month that cyber attacks are one of the unfortunate realities of doing business today. We have run out of time, but Aarti, it's been a fascinating conversation. Aarti Shahani is a business and technology reporter in Silicon Valley, and she has written about this issue for Al Jazeera America. Thank you so much.
Thank you.